From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Marina Ottaway, co-author of a timely new book, A Tale of Four Worlds, The Arab Region After the Uprisings. Long-term Middle East observers and scholars, Marina and her husband David Ottaway, with whom she co-authored the book, have traveled and lived in the region over the past half century. They lived for 3 years in Algeria shortly after its independence from France in 1962. They also lived in Cairo in the 1980s and have gone back to those countries and many others to document the transformations, including before and after the democratic uprisings in 2011. Marina helped to launch and then direct the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Currently, she's a senior Middle East scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She and David, formerly a Middle East correspondent for the Washington Post, set the book in a valuable historical and geopolitical context. They outline and analyze the consequences of three major cataclysmic events that have profoundly shaped the Middle East: the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, the wave of Arab nationalism and socialism inspired by Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 1950s and 60s, and the 2011 uprisings known as the Arab Spring. They argue that the consequences of these events differ greatly from area to area and splinter the Arab region into four different worlds, hence the title. The Levant states have disintegrated, and the Gulf monarchies have embarked on far-reaching plans of economic and social change to stave off discontent. Egypt has retreated into military authoritarianism and a war on Islamists. The countries of the Maghreb, especially Morocco and Tunisia, they argue, may be the only bright spots to emerge from the uprisings, as they have found a way to integrate Islamists into their political systems and offer some hope for progress toward democracy. Well, Marina Ottaway joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center to talk about her new book, A Tale of Four Worlds. Marina, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I should say welcome back.
Yes.
Because we've had the pleasure of having you at these microphones before. Congratulations on this excellent book.
Thank you.
Now, many books, as you know, Marina, have been written about the region. What's the unique perspective and analysis that you and David bring to A Tale of Four Worlds?
Well, we did not look at the uprisings themselves. The uprisings have been extremely well documented. We were more interested in what happened afterwards, and we were not convinced by the narrative that was becoming increasingly prevalent that nothing had changed in the Arab world, which is absolutely wrong in our opinion, because while the protesters did not get what they wanted, a lot of things have changed, and I think they have changed irreversibly.
And so they've changed, and we'll talk about those changes. You distinguish between the countries of the Levant, then the Gulf countries, the countries of the Maghreb, North Africa, and then Egypt has its own category. Let's begin with Egypt, where you lived extensively and studied the uprising in 2011, inspired by that of Tunisia. Why do you think that uprising fizzled, in a sense, such that today Egypt has an even more autocratic regime than that of Mubarak, whose fall was precipitated by the democratic revolt?
I think there were two factors. One is that the army never lost its grip on the country. Mubarak was overthrown not because of the protest, but because the military decided that it was time for him to go. It was the military that ousted him. And despite the fact that there were elections, that at one point a Muslim brother became president of the country, the fact is that behind the scene, power was always in the hands of the military. So that's the first factor. The second one is that the protesters were rather naive, because once Mubarak was overthrown, they hailed the role of the military. They had this slogan, the army and the people are one. And they really did not try to do any of the organizing work, which is needed. It's difficult in any case, but without an organization on the part of the opposition, essentially, they are never going to get anywhere in trying to assert their role in a new political system.
So what about the fact that they were sort of leaderless as well? I think that was perhaps positive in one respect, so that they couldn't be targeted, let's say, by nefarious groups. Just like today we have in Algeria and Hong Kong, it's not the best for future leadership, as you just alluded to.
Well, the problem was not that they did not set forth a figurehead who would immediately have been arrested. In that sense, they were right. But they did not organize among themselves, so that very soon there was squabbling. There is this wing of this movement and that wing of this movement. And as a result, they were pushed aside completely.
And comment, if you will, on today's scenario in Egypt with al-Sisi, with a much stronger grip on the country. The military is as entrenched as ever. I mean, do you see any kind of opening?
No, not at this point. And in fact, we were talking to a member of the opposition who happens to be here, whose name I will not mention, given the situation in the country. And they are all very discouraged because they don't see an opening in the legal political system. And they all know that the population does not want another uprising. The economic price and the price of repression they paid for it, it's too high. So that nobody thinks that anything is going to happen soon.
Let's move to other countries in the Maghreb, Morocco and Tunisia, where everything started, basically. You say in the book that three major trends characterize the politics of the Maghreb that help set it apart from other Arab sub-regions. What are those trends?
Certainly the most important one is the integration of the Islamist parties. Islamist parties are a force in Arab countries, the same way Christian democratic parties have been a force in Europe forever. Not all Islamists are terrorists, not all Islamists are extremists, but they are a force to be confronted. And there is no doubt that if in Egypt there was an election now, for example, probably the Muslim Brothers would win again. That's why there is not going to be an election, because the military know that this is the case. So by absorbing the Islamists, they really did, these countries, manage to make possible some progress towards democracy. They are not democratic countries at this point, not yet, certainly. Morocco in particular is controlled by the king and so on. But there is enough pluralism in the system that there is a dialogue, there are different opinions that are being expressed. And Tunisia just managed to hold very successful elections, whether or not you like the outcome, and many Tunisians don't. But the fact is that these were free and really contested elections.
So basically, integrating Islamists, the so-called moderate Islamists, I mean, groups that don't have armed wings, for example, is one of the things that you advocate.
Yes. It's not that I advocate as such, but the Islamists are a reality, and you cannot make any progress towards democracy if you exclude the largest segment of the population. It's very simple.
And of course, that's simply just a non-starter for countries like Saudi Arabia or other Gulf countries.
Yeah.
They are very hostile.
Well, they are hostile to the participation by anybody. I mean, the Gulf countries are really moving enormously on the economic front. Traveling to the Gulf nowadays, it's like entering another world, essentially. There are these huge cities that are springing up. They are modern. They are very vital. There is a lot going on economically. Saudi Arabia is a bit behind the Emirates or Qatar, but it's moving. Under Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, it's beginning to move economically. They have a long way to go, and they have a long way to go socially, but at least they are moving somewhat. Politically, there is no movement in any of those countries. They are still ruled by families, and that's it. There is no participation by anybody.
Just the families.
It's the ruling families, yes.
In the book, Marina, you and David refer to the term state project.
Yes.
And you say that the countries that have a project and then the agency to pursue them have been the most successful over time. What do you mean by those terms? Can you give us an example or two?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Syria and Iraq were created by the colonial powers. Essentially, the colonial powers were looking for a way of dividing up the Ottoman Empire. France and Britain, who were the two main actors in that drama, divided that area between themselves. And the result was the formation of the Syrian state and the Iraqi state. And there was never, even for the Iraqis and the Syrians, a sense of what kind of countries they wanted to be, where they wanted to go. In that sense, I mean, there was not a state project. By contrast, the person who had a state project was Abdulaziz bin Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia. It was a very traditional state project, a very old-fashioned state project. He wanted to build a large country. That's the way European countries were formed. That's the way the United States extended from coast to coast, essentially. But there was a project there. There was a reason. There was a vision of what they wanted to be. Now, that was back in the 20s. So that vision became no longer valid now. And what is interesting is that Mohammed bin Salman is coming with a new vision for the country. I don't approve of Mohammed bin Salman. What he did in the case of Jamal Khashoggi cannot be overlooked. But the fact is that he's playing what I would call a historically important role in finally getting this country moving again. And maybe this is overly cynical on my part, but maybe it requires somebody who is totally ruthless to get a country moving again. Again, I don't say this is a sign of approval, but if you look at it in a historical perspective, maybe it takes a person like that to get the country moving.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Marina Ottaway. She's senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and co-author of A Tale of Four Worlds, The Arab Region After the Uprisings. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Lokichar, Kenya, Winston Madabit. Thanks for writing in. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And before the break, Marina, we were talking about Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman going forward economically. But even in your book, you dedicate the book to Jamal Khashoggi and yes, others like him who are fighting for a freer Middle East. Yes. So we can't really avoid human rights.
And we have to keep it in mind. But we also need to put it in perspective, essentially, what's happening. And this was a country that, you know, seemed to be frozen in time and space. And it is moving. Sometimes, as in this case, it's moving in the wrong direction. There is no doubt that there is a lot of corruption in the countries. There is no doubt about the authoritarianism in the country. But some things are beginning to change.
Another major theme in the book, Marina, are the fault lines between the secular groups and Islamists. I'd like you to also talk about these fault lines, to what extent they've remained in some countries and where they may have been attenuated and where there's more success.
The fault lines are very real. If you see religion as your guide in politics, you are not going to get along very well with secularists. We have the same problem here in this country. There is hardline liberals and evangelicals don't exactly see eye to eye in the United States. So there is a parallel. The issue is whether they accept each other's existence. And I think what's happening in the Maghreb, including in Algeria, that in the 90s had terrible civil war, essentially, they have accepted each other's existence and the fact that somehow everybody has to accommodate it in the political system. In Egypt, they have not. In Saudi Arabia, they have not. The royal family is not accepting anybody's legitimacy.
Exactly. That's an extreme case. Yes. Well, speaking of Algeria, I think the current protests happened probably after the publication of your book, The So-Called Revolution of Smiles. I'd like to know if you think that Algeria's Democrats might be able to avoid the fate of their counterparts in Egypt, the country that has a similar, very deep role for the army in controlling politics and the economy, and where the military found ways with the help of Saudi Arabia and the UAE to beat back the democratic tide in Egypt in 2011.
You are right. First of all, we don't talk about the 2019 uprising because they started after the book had gone to press. But in my opinion, what we are witnessing now is the beginning of a second wave of uprising. The first wave in 2011 and 2019, you have the second wave that starts in Algeria, then goes on to the Sudan, and now most recently, this fall, protest has broken out in Lebanon and in Iraq. Now, I see some differences, and the differences to me are much clearer when you look at Algeria and the Sudan, because the uprisings in Lebanon and Iraq are very new. I can't quite tell which way they are going and so on, but what is clear, protesters knew that they had a very difficult job ahead of them in trying to remove entrenched military regimes. And they never deluded themselves that it could be a quick operation. In Egypt, Mubarak was overthrown in a matter of a couple of weeks. And a lot of the participants in the protest thought that was it. It was done. They hailed the military. Nowadays, having seen the experience of the other countries, protesters know that they are in it for the long duration. One example which is quite interesting is Algeria, because the Algerians succeeded in essentially forcing former President Abdulaziz Bouteflika not to run for a fifth term. It was ridiculous that he was running. He was an old man in a wheelchair, but he was insisting on running. He was forced not to run. But the military immediately took over and said, okay, we are going to have elections in 3 weeks. And the protesters said, no way. And in fact, the military gave up on that. Elections are still set for December 12th. The protesters don't want those elections. They still have weekly demonstrations. They are not trying to bring out millions of people at one time, but they keep up the pressure on the government. Government still says that the elections will take place, and I think they will take place because the military can make it happen. Protesters have already said that they will not go and vote, and that they will continue the protest afterwards. So there has been sort of a perpetuation of the protest. And at some point, I think they'll have to do something about that. The protesters and the government will have to deal with each other.
Exactly. So to some extent, they are heeding some lessons from Egypt.
They certainly, I think there is a learning curve. That same in the Sudan, I will not go into details, but in Sudan, the protester and the military government managed to negotiate with each other and reach an agreement on a 3-year transition period. They are not out of the stick. At some point, the military can say, sorry, we are going to stay where we are. But certainly there has been a different concept of how you go about a transition.
Maureen, I'd like to go back to the Gulf. You know, we talked about Saudi Arabia, which is almost a case in and of itself. We did see protests there, but we saw protests after 2011 in Bahrain, but they were put down with the help of Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
That's a small kingdom that is predominantly Shia, but it's ruled by a Sunni monarch and a monarchy.
Yes.
I wonder how you would characterize Bahrain in particular, or some of the Gulf countries, the smaller ones, both the limitations and some of the progress.
Bahrain essentially has become, maybe this is an extreme word, but a colony of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is controlling Bahrain, and as long as that continues, there is not going to be any change there. Other countries are interesting because, let me mention some of those that are not very often mentioned. Kuwait. Kuwait is the only country that has a parliament. It has had a parliament for a long time. It was suspended at one point. The United States forced Kuwait to reinstate the parliament after the Gulf War, after it helped liberate Kuwait and so on. The problem with that is that they are a bad example for the region because they are always paralyzed. The political game seems to consist of the parliament trying to bring down the government, and the government are trying to disband the parliament and have new elections. That's not a way to govern the country. So that, in fact, unfortunately, other countries in the region look at Kuwait and say, who wants a democracy? Who wants a parliament if that is what you are doing? And as a result, in many ways, it's falling behind in terms of its culture, in terms of, you know, moving into new areas and so on. The United Arab Emirates, in my opinion, is the most interesting of the Gulf countries, because it's the one where there is an enormous amount of dynamism. They have developed their economy. Oil is still, you know, at least for Abu Dhabi, it's still the main earner of foreign revenue and so on. But they are developing all sorts of other fields. And they are also developing a new culture, a new approach to things. The new generation is very different from the old generation. And I'm very struck by the fact that whenever I go to the Emirates, I meet young Saudis that have gone to work in the Emirates because they feel that there is a very different situation there. There are two problems for these countries, I would say. One, that they still cannot go past the ruling families. Some of these economies are becoming modern economies and they are still ruled by a family. It's a major problem. The other problem, very evident in the Emirates, although it's also evident in Qatar and so on, is that a lot of people who have made this economic resurgence possible are not Emiratis. They are foreigners. One of the most interesting experiences the last time I was in the Emirates, I had to meet somebody in Dubai, and I was there for a short period of time. And he said, come down to one of the malls and we'll have dinner there on a Friday night. And it was really an eye-opening experience, because what these malls become, you know, it's very hot and nobody wants to be outside. So the malls are the place where... And this is what you look at there is the middle class of the Emirates, and the middle class, it's all Indian and Pakistanis. Hmm. So the Emiratis don't go out that way, but there are these large crowds of families, and these are not the poor immigrant workers who work in construction. This is the management and technical class of these countries. They live well, they have been there sometimes for two generations, and they are not citizens. And at some point, these countries have to address that problem. But it's not easy to address because the foreigners greatly outnumber the nationals. But that's a major crisis that's coming that they will have to address.
Right. Marina, I want to go back to another important country that you alluded to, Syria. After the uprising in 2011, of course, we saw Bashar al-Assad crack down on the protesters who were protesting peacefully for a democracy. He cracked down in the mold of his father, Hafez al-Assad. I just interviewed Sam Dagher, who wrote the book Assad or We Burn the Country, which I think encapsulates exactly what happened. But I wanted to ask you quickly, is it salvageable, do you think, as a state? You said it was like Iraq after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, you know, didn't have a state project. But I just wanted to know how you see it, because so many countries, the United States could have intervened at certain points. It did not under Obama. I don't know whether outside powers could have made a difference, because you talk about the role of outside powers extensively in the book as well.
Your question was, is it salvageable? It will be saved, because the international community does not want Syria to disappear. In the aftermath of World War II, there is a real strong feeling in the world that countries that are there have to keep on staying there. We don't like secessions, we don't like countries disappearing, which is, in the history of the world, is something that's quite new. So that I think Syria will remain an entity as such. It will become, I think, what I call a non-state country. There will be a country called Syria. Will it be a functioning state? That I really very much doubt. It will be kept there as it is now by the Russians, by the Iranians, and so on. And one thing which is very interesting, if you follow closely what has been happening now after withdrawal of the U.S. troops, all the negotiations have been taking place. It's between Turkey and Russia, between Turkey and the United States. There has been no negotiation in which the Syrian government was directly involved. Essentially, it's a world of outsiders at this point.
I see. And the role of the United States in particular, or Europe, could the United States have been more instrumental in shaping a more positive outcome, let's say in Syria or perhaps in Iraq, given the U.S.-led invasion and then the lack of attention to how the whole aftermath was taking place?
I don't think so, because Look at what happened in Iraq. We invaded, we controlled, we were there from 203 to 210 with a massive presence. Then we went back after 2014 with a much more reduced presence. And we put a lot of money in that country. We don't know how to construct a new state. I don't think it's only the United States. I don't think anybody else knows how to do it. But so we don't have the capacity to put all the pieces together that are needed to really form a functioning state. And that's why I am skeptical about the United States' continued presence in these countries, in the sense that we don't have a clear view of why we are there and what we want to do there. I don't approve of the way President Trump pulled troops all of a sudden out of Syria without rhyme or reason, without any preparations and so on. But I think it's important to understand that we are not doing much good by being there. The U.S. presence in Iraq, for example, which is still, you know, we are spending a lot of money. Yes, we helped undermine the caliphate. ISIS no longer controlled territory, although it's still very much there. But the influence that we have on the Iraqi government is very small. So that the question becomes, what are we doing there? Are we helping Iraq, essentially, only to fall under the control of Iran? So why are we there? But also, more importantly, what should be our role there? And I think that's the discussion that the United States has to undertake, but not all of a sudden say we go home, because that certainly does not help us and does not help anybody else.
One could even argue that when the United States went in 2003 under George W. Bush, by doing that, we handed the country to some extent over to Iran. I mean, Iran already had a natural affinity. And then with the Shia majority, thanks to democracy, they had more in common. And Iran also took advantage and exploited the vacuum.
Well, I think the problem with our intervention is that we really did not understand the country. We did not know what we were doing. And we went there with great illusions about what we could accomplish.
Let's close, Marina, by saying that I think your premise is right on, in the sense that notwithstanding the fact that the so-called Arab Spring of 2010, 2011 has not really flourished or come to fruition, except for perhaps in Tunisia, and of course Morocco is going in the right direction, but we're seeing the resurgence of protests now and the call for democracy in Iraq and in Lebanon, and we're seeing less identity politics, less sectarian politics in both places. These Iraq protests are perhaps led by Shia, but all sects, whether it's the Sunni and Kurds, there seems to be a certain convergence of grievances against corruption, against the elite, against the lack of services and lack of jobs. And then also a common foe, Iran. You hear the chants, Iran, get out. And then Hezbollah in Lebanon. I was just wondering if you could comment on that. In Lebanon, well, also Hezbollah, which is connected to Iran, they're seen very critically nowadays.
There has been a lot written along the lines of what you just discussed. I remain somewhat skeptical that this is indeed the case. I think the sectarian divide is still very deep. There have always been people who wanted to try and overcome, particularly among the youth. To me, one very telling example is in Iraq. The protesters are Shias. The Sunnis are not protesting because they fear that if they protest, then they will be targeted as being against the government and so on. And well, that tells you that they don't feel that they are the same as the Shia. So the time I'm skeptical, and also about the depth of the anti-Iranian feeling. There is no doubt that there is in the streets and so on. Let's not forget all the groups that are allied with Iran, all the militias that are allied with Iran. So I think a lot of those commentaries on the anti-Hezbollah feelings, the anti-Iranian feeling and so on, are picking and choosing, you know, bits of evidence. And the situation is infinitely more complicated.
We will be watching this unfolding, of course, in the weeks ahead. But I want to thank you very much for coming in, Marina, and talking about your new book, A Tale of Four Worlds, The Arab Region After the Uprisings.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA.
on The Voice of America.